I'm Dan Waters, and you're listening to Spoiler Country.
Hey, hey, people of Earth, it's time to enter the Spoilerverse via our secret portal at the exclusive Arctic Club in beautiful downtown Seattle with our hosts, John and Kenrick. Welcome to Spoiler Country.
Hey, if you're listening to our show for the first time and you're on one of the social medias that we're on, like Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, any of those kinds of things, you should always check us out on Spoilerverse.com. But if you want to keep up with our latest episodes, you should bring out your smartphone, get into your favorite podcatcher, find Spoiler Country, and hit subscribe. Then you'll get all our new stuff.
And if you want to reach out to us, you can do that in two ways. You can call us, leave us a voicemail at 707-656-2080. Again, 707-656-2080. Or you can shoot us an email at spoilercountry@gmail.com. Welcome back to Spoiler Country. I am Johnny Horstein. I got today with me Melissa Sercha, and today she talked to the one and the only, the Dan Waters, about some new project that he's got going. Melissa, how's it going?
It's going good. How are you doing today?
I'm doing good. My wife and I have been shiplopping some walls in our house and painting, so we've been staying up all like late night, like putting up boards on the walls and painting stuff, so I'm exhausted, but I'm doing good.
Nice. Well, I'm glad you can make it today.
So you talked with Dan about his new project, right?
Yeah, I did. He was great. And I have to say, you know, it was really nice of him to chat because it was actually like 3 a.m. in England when I called him. And I had no idea that he was not in the States. Otherwise, I would have felt worse. But that was very sweet. And he was a big supporter about it. And yeah, we chatted about some new comics he has coming out. Homesick Pilots is one of them. And, you know, just his horror genre and his career and just, yeah, everything about comics. It was a really fun interview.
That is awesome. So what do you say we just sit back and listen to Dan Waters in his own words?
Spoiler Country, and I'm Melissa Sercha. Today, I'd like to welcome comic book writer known for Lucifer of the Sandman universe, Limbo, Coffin Bound, Homesick Pilots, and The Picture of Everything Else, Mr. Dan Waters. Welcome to the show.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here tonight. How are you doing?
Yeah, not bad. It's pretty late London end, but that's the joy of working on American comics.
Oh, wow. See, I wasn't sure if you were actually in the UK currently or in the States.
Yeah, no, I'm still London based, so
yeah.
we're all locked down at the moment, but pretty used to sort of running on American time at this point.
Okay, yeah, well, I really appreciate you being on the show tonight. So I really want to start off by, you know, talking about one of your new comic books that's coming out next month, actually, Homesick Pilots. It's set in the 90s. It's about a girl who's lead singer of a punk band. She goes missing, finds herself in a traveling haunted house. What can you tell us about the character and the house without giving away any spoilers?
Well, I mean, I guess the premise of the book is pretty much as you laid it out. So the character is Annie, and she's the singer and guitarist of the Homesick Pilots, which are a high school punk band. She's sort of pissed off. She's 17, so she's all the things that 17-year-olds are. There's definitely a lot of sort of, yeah, I definitely drew from more personal experience for that book than I have for most of my stuff. Nice. I think 17-year-olds are horrible people.
I was a horrible 17-year-old.
That's not fair, but I know I was.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, some of these guys are definitely better than others. But yeah, the idea is that the band are looking for somewhere to throw a gig illegally, and they end up breaking into this house, which turns out to be a haunted house, which doesn't quite go the way it normally does. There's enough sort of bloodshed and stuff to go around, but it's the idea that we find she has a connection to this place, as in she's on a similar sort of wavelength to it. So they like each other, essentially, and they sort of fill each other's blank spaces. So it's kind of where it all goes from there.
Okay, very cool. So music, I'm guessing, clearly plays a big role in the story.
Yeah,
what songs did you have on your playlist when you were writing this?
Oh, man. I mean, Catherine and I actually put together a playlist which we need to like actually put out into the world. What was I listening to? I went back and listened to a lot of the stuff I was listening to when I was sort of 17, which granted wasn't all around in 1994, but I guess like the Homesick Pilots, like it's definitely, I was listening to a lot of Jawbreaker, which sort of seemed that's the sort of correct mix between being punk and also being very sort of melancholy, which is definitely the sort of tone that fits the book. The Descendants, the Ramones, a lot of that kind of, there's definitely a sort of bubblegum element to the book. And Casper sort of leans more on the sort of like grunge stuff. A lot of grunge, a lot of sort of like Riot Girl and stuff like that.
Oh, nice. Yeah, you can't have the 90s without grunge, for sure.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, I find it interesting the sort of like crossover in scenes and stuff back then, because there is an edge of punk where it can be quite purist, which is a very sort of strange thing for a scene like that to do, where it started out very, you know, very much like we're going to do whatever the hell we want. And then it sort of turns into something where it's like, well, no, if you listen to metal, that sucks, and this sucks, and that sucks. And, you know, if you sign to a bigger label, then that sucks, which, you know, there's philosophies behind that. But the whole grunge thing as an extension of punk, or as something that plugs into punk, I find an interesting sort of evolution.
Yeah.
That was sort of like, we're going to slam punk and metal together with a bit of acid rock.
Right. Yeah. And then I think at some point, if I can remember correctly, I'm reaching now back to my younger days. The ska kind of came into the picture and was sort of tying into punk
a little bit
as well.
I think that was there from the beginning, right? Like the Clash was like that. I mean, if you look at the UK side of things, the 77 stuff, they were all like massively like, into that stuff, like the whole Sex, which, you know, is where the Pistols started, was on the King's Road, and that was a massive sort of like Jamaican community around there. And like, I know they've talked a lot about sort of just going out and buying reggae records, and that's what they were mainly listening to.
Yeah, so definitely had that influence. You could hear it in their music, and then in the ska music as well, you could hear the punk influences and a little bit of metal as well, but I think mostly punk.
Yeah, for sure. But then it's weird, because then it's the sort of like generations after that who then sort of, on certain ends, they try and sort of like clarify everything down, and it's something you see like again and again that happens across all sorts of genres, where they'll try and go like, all right, this counts and this doesn't, so if you do it this way, then you're doing it properly, and if you're doing it any other way, then it's wrong. And it just gets duller and duller and duller as the generations proceed.
Yeah, well, it kind of defeats the purpose of what all forms of rock music really set out to do, you know, is not to avoid, you know, avoid labels and not be put into a box.
Yeah, and have fun. That's the bit which can get forgotten really quickly.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, the 90s was an interesting, you know, decade I lived in. I was a teenager in the 90s. We were sort of clinging to aspects of the 80s still, but at the same time going in like a complete opposite direction. Did you have any bits of 80s nostalgia that seeped into this story?
I mean, I wasn't there in the 80s.
Right.
I was born in 91, so
okay.
But that said, Casper and I, yeah, Casper is very much a sort of a product of the 80s. He's a little bit older than me. Mm-hmm. And our first book, Limbo, which is definitely, you know, a lot of Limbo's DNA is in Homesick Pilots. It's not a sequel. They're not set in the same world or anything like that. But Homesick Pilots definitely originated from us sitting down and thinking about doing a second Limbo and then deciding to do this instead.
Okay.
And Limbo was a very 80s book, and Casper and I bonded in the first place over our love of sort of 80s, 90s horror stuff. Because there's a wild sort of freedom in a lot of that, especially the sort of films that were coming out, like Brian Yuzna and Cronenberg and all those sort of things, like those really good ones and then also the really awful ones. We both love all of that stuff, and that's really what we drew on for that. And yeah, there's plenty of that in this, like the house films. Have you seen those? Those are like sort of oscillate between the so good it's bad and just bad. Or if, so yeah, I think the house film started in the 80s. I'm double guessing myself now, but
Yeah, I want to say that it did, actually. I think you're right.
Yeah. So, yes. And, like, Return of the Living Dead is obviously is another really big influence, which is a very, very 80s film.
Oh, that's good. Now, I'm a big George Romero fan, so that's good to hear. It's kind of, I think, one of those writers that it's kind of hard not to be influenced by him if you're going to write horror, just because he defined such a niche, you know, genre with the zombie films that he did. So I definitely think that.
Oh yeah, Romero's also, like, I think one of the biggest sort of, like, the way he sort of innovated stuff was crazy. Like the Night of the Living Dead hit such a chord, I think, because it took this social angle, which people hadn't seen horror do. I mean, horror's always had a huge social anger. It's always been about tapping into things we're afraid of, but he sort of got there first when it came to the zombie thing, and he sort of did it again with Dawn of the Dead and the sort of consumerism metaphor in that. But then, like, other stuff he did as well, which is, like, less sort of lauded, but, like, Martin, which is his weird sort of isn't he vampire film, where it's just about this sort of crazy teenager who's sort of stabbing people with syringes,
right?
And, like, that was, again, like, I think just, like, a really, really interesting take on the vampire genre. So he always sort of innovated, and I always think that's the coolest stuff, even if it doesn't work.
Yeah, just to attempt it and it's still, you're pulling it off, even, you know, it's all subject to interpretation, I guess, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think as long as you put something out into the world that has a place and, like, wasn't there before, you've done something at least. made your presence known.
Exactly. Well, there's been a ton of hype and for Homesick Pilots and lots of really positive early reviews. One reviewer said, sleek original horror mixed with 90s teen drama. Would you say that's an accurate description?
Yeah, I don't see why not.
Yeah,
there's a lot of stuff. It's sort of, the book definitely sort of transforms as it goes, so we're throwing a lot of stuff into it that I don't think people expect, even at this point. People who've seen the first couple.
Okay. And so when you reunited with Casper Wingard, you've worked with him on Limbo.
Yeah,
what was it like reuniting and collaborating again?
I mean, so Limbo was, for both of us, it was our first create our own thing. It was our first sort of presence in the industry. We did that book knowing no one really in comics, and with no idea how the industry really worked. We were flying by the seat of our pants so much, but we also were doing it with the sort of network network of people around us who were very good and still very good friends, like Ryan O'Sullivan. We were already really close with and working with, who's one of the writers in White Noise, my studio. And we didn't have much of a clue what we were doing, but the book was something we really just enjoyed making, and we had a real blast with it. And then it led to other things for both of us, and he kind of got pulled towards Marvel, I got kind of pulled towards DC, and we ended up not working together for a good long while now, which is always kind of weird, because we always kind of considered ourselves a creative team as well.
Yeah. Did you two meet during doing comics, or did you know each other beforehand?
Yeah, no, I mean, we met because we both wanted to do comics. We both did some work for a sort of, like, small micro publisher, and from there we met each other, and we ended up as a creative team because we were the ones who could hold out in the pub longest. so we'd start talking about all these ideas in the pub, and it turned into Limbo.
People, I like to know.
Yeah. I mean, we were a bit younger back then. And so coming back together was always on the cards. It was always something we talked about. And we also talk, like, almost every day, at least sort of through Messenger and stuff like that. So, because, you know, we're good friends. So we've always been, it was never a sort of thing of, like, falling out of contact and then just, like, going, like, oh, hey, what are you doing at the moment? Like, we've always known what each other's have had on our plates, and we've always been trying to look for a sort of place and the right sort of place and time to come back together and do something. And like I said, like, we thought that was going to be another Limbo book, but we got too excited about Homesick Pilots instead. So we decided to make this.
Yeah. We call that chasing plot bunnies in the author book novel world.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Plot bunnies when you're like, shiny new idea. But clearly it's worked out for you.
Yeah. We chased it all the way to the end. I think that's the trick, right?
Not yeah.
It's easy to chase them as soon as the current one gets difficult.
Yeah, exactly.
You get that sentiment as well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And then you, before you know it, you have, you know, 9 unfinished novels in front of you.
Oh, yeah.
So when you're like first plotting it or conceptualizing it, did you come up with like the setting and the genre first, or did the character come to you first, or was it kind of both, like symbiotic?
I think it was definitely the characters, actually, because the Homesick Pilots, the 3 of them, which is Amy, Rip, and Buzz, and they all, you know, they've all got sort of different crap going on in their lives, which sort of pushed them towards punk and towards each other as a sort of band, but really they're a family unit. And we talked about bringing in these punk kids for the second Limbo, and Casper drew them. And it's a thing which I find happens a lot with sort of artists, is they'll draw something and then as a writer it really sparks ideas, and you see these characters, and once they have faces, suddenly they have these, like, they immediately have these really full, fleshed out personalities.
Yeah.
So we had these kids which were going to be, you know, a sort of secondary story, and all of a sudden we sort of looked at them and went, oh no, these guys are more than that. They deserve their own proper story. So it all kind of came out of that, I think.
Yeah.
it's a strange one because books like this, they're so collaborative, but we spend so long on the phone talking about ideas and things we wanted to do that it's hard to find those or remember those exact nexus points.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those certain like sparks of creativity. Yeah. And so how many issues do you have planned for this series? Is it going to be ongoing, or do you have like an end goal?
It's ongoing, and we know the end, which is always the ideal, ideal yeah. way. So how long we get there will be sort of defined by, you know, how long we can keep doing this and how long we want to keep doing it as well. I'm always very, very in favor of things having ends. I like endings.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like there's a stigma about endings in this industry in particular, because things used to run for sort of 100 issues, and that's not really viable anymore. But also, I don't know many things. I'm gonna get myself in trouble now because someone I know is gonna have a really good one and I'm gonna have forgotten it. But I can't think of many 100 issue things that are just good from beginning to end.
Yeah it's hard to keep up with. I mean, even, you know, it's the same with television as well. You know, people always get upset when a season or when a show gets canceled, or when the writers choose to end it, essentially, not get canceled. Yeah. But
they always have to clarify, don't they?
Yeah, they, I know.
They always have to go, no, it's not canceled. Because it's a weird, I think there's a weird expectation or sort of just general assumption that you want to do something forever.
Yeah.
Which I don't think is actually the case for most storytellers. Like, right. I'm pretty sure most novelists are ecstatic when they finish their book.
Yeah, well, I think at some point too, I mean, you know, readers, you know, maybe that don't know, like, they're not writers, they don't understand that sometimes you just get burnt out on a certain world if you're in it too long, and then you don't want the story to suffer for that. You know, you kind of want to end it when things are still popular and still people are still interested in it, and then give it some finality, and then you can move on to something else, right?
Yeah, for sure. Like, and also, I think generally, I mean, there are things that are a little bit more amorphous and flexible, but generally speaking, when you're telling a story, it's because you've got something you want to explore for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Like a sort of, I don't know, say thesis, and then I make stories sound really boring, but it kind of is. It's like you have this sort of idea of something, or you go like, oh, what would happen if XYZ, and you kind of want to explore that idea. And once you've done that, especially for yourself, once you kind of told yourself that story, mm-hmm. Then yeah, I think you tend to be kind of done. It's, you know, it's easy to sort of fall in love with the characters and let it sort of churn onwards just for the sake of spending more time with them. But I don't think a lot of things benefit from that.
Yeah. And you can also, there's ways to leave it, you know, open-ended, I guess, in a sense where, you know, it's the end, but you can revisit it, you know, especially when you're writing horror or fantasy.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
You know, you can always go back 10, you know, 5-10 years from now and be like, you know what, I'm going to reopen this and, you know, base it off of a different character or, you know, another character in that universe.
Yeah, I mean, so I've just wrapped the second volume of Coffin Bound, which is my other Image book. And that book is one that we're very much treating that way, in that we've done two books in 2 years. We've done two volumes, and I mean the book's called Coffin Bound, and that's very much the premise.
Yeah,
is that every volume is about death. It's about someone's death. So it lets us explore different facets of death in each volume, but also each volume, when it's done, that story's over. So we can sort of revisit it whenever we want to come back to it. But we're not sort of beholden to telling 30 issues of the same story, because it's just not that.
Yeah. No, I read the first issue and I was like, oh, wow, this is different, you know, and like in a good way. Like I've never read anything like that before. I love the vulture as a character. I thought that was really interesting and different. And the character... I was actually going to ask you this about, because you actually create really unique female characters.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. And so Izzy in Coffin Bound, you know, is a very rough around the edges, you know, character. And like I said, I've only read the first issue. So I'm curious to see how it plays out as it goes on. But, you know, how do you tackle that, you know, as writing these female characters that are so edgy and different and have like layers to them? They're not the stereotypical female that you tend to see in comic books.
You know, so Dani, the artist on Coffin Bound, I think she was winding me up. she asked me one time when we were sort of out and about in New York at one point, and she said to me, do you think you're good at writing female characters? And I was like, well, what do you think? You're drawing Izzy at the moment. You know, we created her together. Do you think she's a good female character? And she thought about it for a bit, and she's like, well, like, she didn't need to be a female character. Like, she's just a character. And I was like, yeah, there you go.
Yeah, I like that you can literally switch it out. It doesn't have to be gender specific.
Yeah, I mean, I think I don't know. Just treating people like they're people is the bottom line, I think.
Yeah.
Letting them and. I think sometimes there's, when especially writing into sort of universes where you've got, you know, a load of classic male characters, you know, like the sort of bigger superhero universes, then you end up with sort of one female on one woman on the team, and then there becomes this like pressure for them to represent all womankind, and then they have to be kind of perfect and you know they kick ass and all this kind of stuff, because it's like, look, we're giving a kick ass female, but then they actually have no personality because they don't get to like screw up like everyone else,
right?
So I think just avoiding any of that sort of malarkey.
She kind of reminds me of, there was a movie, oh god, this was like 10 years ago, probably maybe longer, the movie called Domino, and it was based on the real life lady named Domino, who was a supermodel who turned bounty hunter. I think she passed away before the movie came out, but it was played by Keira Knightley. And it was such an interesting film because you have this female character who it just kind of defies, like you said, non-gender conforming. And it was something different that we hadn't seen in film at the time, I think. But that character kind of reminds me of Domino.
Man, I haven't seen that film.
It's a really good film. Really,
yeah. I mean, I thought when we started the book, I thought Izzy was going to be a bit mopier than she turned out to be. I thought she was going to be a little bit more, maybe a little bit more like the Crow, like a little bit sort of like maudlin and sort of a little bit more Joy Division.
Right.
And she didn't end up that way at all. And I think a lot of that's down to Dani. Like she ended up with a lot of Dani's sort of design. And obviously she's entirely designed by Dani, but,
right.
But Dani, like I expressed this to Dani as well. And she said that she'd actually based Izzy physically on one of her friends who is also quite,
That's cool.
Angry and fiery and stuff. And so it crept into the writing as well, which I always think is a really interesting thing that can happen without any actual conversation.
Yeah. That's really cool. Well, speaking of dark and angry characters, you've also written for Lucifer, the Sandman series. So I'm curious, did you have to, or did you choose to consult with like Neil Gaiman at all? Is it Gaiman or Gaiman? I've heard it both ways.
Gaiman.
Gaiman. Okay. I say Gaiman, but I've heard other people say Gaiman. I'm like, I don't know if that's right. Oh, nice. Awesome. So you did get to consult with him and talk to him about where he wanted the character to go.
Yeah, but like, he wasn't interested in where he wanted it to go, which was nice. Oh. Yeah, when we sort of started the whole Sandman universe, we met up with Neil in New Orleans, of all places.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah, and it was, I can't do Fahrenheit, but it was -7 degrees Celsius
okay.
in New Orleans, which is very cold. And I don't think it had hit that lower temperature before that.
Interesting.
So it was snowing in New Orleans.
That's crazy.
So yeah, that was a whole thing, and we went out and spent a few days with him, just like breaking story and stuff. And he entirely came in and said, "I want to see what you guys can do with these characters. I want to see where you guys want to take them." And sort of just gave us permission to break all his toys.
Wow.
Which is exactly what you want to hear as a writer as well.
Absolutely, yeah. Because I was going to ask you, did you feel any pressure, you know, upholding, you know, the original character, but like while still putting your own spin on it?
Yeah, I mean, I guess my sort of reaction to that, any of that kind of pressure, is to just kick very hard in my own direction. Because I love Sandman. I love Carey's Lucifer. I've read those books since I was a teenager.
Yeah.
It's a sort of, I think, tale as old as time with a lot of comic readers, and I sort of fell out of comics in my early teens and came back in through my late teens through books like Sandman and Lucifer and all these, you know, the sort of Vertigo stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So that stuff was always very dear to me, which is why I sort of looked at them and went, well, I don't want to go anywhere near any of it, and I don't want to do any of that stuff again. I don't want to repeat any of it. I don't want my Lucifer to feel like Mike Carey's Lucifer.
Mm-hmm.
because it's just pointless. Like those books are so good. I'm not going to improve on them. So I'll just do something entirely different.
Do your own, version of it. And were you just like ecstatic when you got the thumbs up from him? Like after you submitted, you know, your first issue for him, did it go over well?
Oh yeah, for sure. Like it's definitely a relief. I think relief is the first emotion that comes in. But yeah, I loved writing that book. It was so fun. Like I spent 2 years, I wrote an issue of that every month for 2 years. And that's spending a lot of time with the devil.
Yeah. Well, and it's nice to see the different interpretations, I think. Like you said, like, you know, the TV show is very campy and it's got a lot of humor in it. And I like that version too, because it's kind of light. And obviously I think they had to do it that way because for audiences to digest it, you know, on and television.
Budget, I would imagine.
Yeah,
well.
Budget. Yeah, exactly. But no, it's nice to see. 23
episodes set in pandemonium would bankrupt any studio, I think.
Right. Game of Thrones all over again. I did notice there is, you know, there's a dark undercurrent that flows through a lot of your comic books. You've always been a horror fan. Like, have you always been attracted to like the darker stuff?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I love horror. I always have. I'm way more of a horror fan than a fantasy or a sci-fi fan, really. Not that I don't like love all sorts of stuff. At the moment, I've just written 2 issues of Superman Wonder Woman.
Oh, cool.
Which I was for the Future State stuff, which is coming out in January and February. And that I was really, really pleased, and I sort of told them as well. I told DC, I was like really pleased that you guys hit me up for this stuff, because I've done so many villains at this point. It was really cool just to do something really the other end of that. I just wanted to do something really optimistic and just really fun and light. But I do, my natural space is definitely in the horror stuff, and I've always been. I was always that kid as well. Well, I think my mom just made Halloween's too fun.
Yeah.
She used to deck the house out in like cotton wool with cobwebs and spiders and sort of 6-foot witch decorations and all this kind of stuff. And I don't think I ever looked back from there.
That's awesome. Now, Halloween is my favorite holiday as well.
Oh, it's the best.
I deck my house out as well. It's just, I don't know, all that dark, creepy stuff. It, I don't know what it is about it, right? Like, we just like being scared or creeped out.
I have really sort of, I overthink all of this stuff. And I think there's also a side of horror where horror is less, or it very much can, but it's less inclined to lead towards sort of conservative outcomes than mm-hmm. most other genres.
Yeah.
Just because it's intrinsically dealing with things that are like traumatic and things that are, you know, very sort of deep, mm-hmm. Deep within us, deep and primal, but also don't need, like, most stories are about some form of overcoming or some form of learning, and horror can kind of invert that
mm-hmm.
A lot easier than most other genres, and just sort of say, you know, this is something these are the things that destroy us, and these are the things that we cannot get over, and we cannot, which I think is also, you know, very worth and very worthy looking at, because it's facts of life. And if we sort of think we can overcome everything and you know, as long as we face our fears, they won't bother us anymore. Then when they do come back around to kick our ass, you know, in sort of low moments or anything else, then,
mm-hmm.
you know, we feel lied to by our stories.
Yeah.
And I don't think our stories should lie to us.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's why, you know, with horror films, there's also this feeling of, you know, redemption. You know, there's always like a redemption arc in the film or the book or whatever that you can appreciate, because that's, you know, it gives you something to root for. And then you also tend to, you know, you put yourself into the story and think, what would I do? You know, how would I react? Would I, you know, run or, you know, hide or whatever you would, you know, would react as a human being in one of those situations when your adrenaline gets going. So I think it's interesting how we can kind of like sort of not relive, but, you know, kind of imagine like what that would be like, but still from the safety of our own couch. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's definitely that sort of cathartic element. And, but yeah, even when they don't get out of it, we can still kind of get that catharsis from it, because it's sort of, we're the ones who have been at that point, we're the ones who've sort of gone somewhere dark and into the unknown and watched, you know, seen something traumatic like unfold, right. And we emerge from that and we have to struggle with it. I also think it's probably why the sort of early 2000s torture porn sort of movement was kind of intrinsically uninteresting,
right? I agree.
Because it was, once you're sort of siding with the, or supposed to sort of, you're sort of put more on the voyeur side, and
mm-hmm.
you're entirely on that, you know, seeing it through the eyes of the killers and things. It's like, it can work, it can be fine, but it's not as cathartic, it's not as interesting. It's,
no.
I think, fooling ourselves into thinking we're more in control than we are.
Yeah, no, I agree. I like more of the classic horror films. I mean, there, to be honest, there hasn't been a lot of newer stuff that I've been like, oh, that's really good. You know, I like The Shining, you know, and then the Friday the 13th movies and the Halloween movies. And I feel like those were just, well, they're nostalgic for one thing too, of course, but I just liked those, that classic sort of simplistic storytelling, you know, rather than some of these new ones that have come out are just so over the top.
Yeah. I mean, I think Shining is wildly complex. I mean, that was one of our huge touchstones for Homesick Pilots. The idea that the Overlook Hotel is basically inside of Jack Torrance's head. It's his demons, and you know, that's what's being confronted. You're walking around inside someone's head and seeing their ghosts. And that was our big sort of idea with Homesick Pilots, is the idea of a haunted house is a single psyche.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, like, it's a metaphor for the mind, and ghosts are traumas, which I think is a lot of. I think that's the primary thing, the thing that ghosts are there as a metaphor for, or at least have been historically. And yeah, I also think that there's been a few quite prominent recent examples that have really kind of messed up with that metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
In quite major ways, in that they sort of use that metaphor, but because they want to round out their stories in satisfying
mm-hmm.
audience friendly ways, it becomes about if you confront your trauma and you know, you sort of face it head on, and then you overcome it. And that's just not how trauma works.
Right.
You don't overcome it. You can learn to live with it, and you can learn to walk with it, and you can learn to make it work for you if you're very, very lucky. But you can't. Yeah. It's still going to be there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Which is why
I think the Babadook is a brilliant film, a recent horror film.
Oh, I haven't seen that one yet. No, it's okay. I'll watch it anyways. I mean, if it's a good film.
Oh, yeah. That's a great one. I think that was a really good from the last couple of years.
Okay, good. Yeah. No, I haven't seen any good ones lately. Actually this Halloween, I just watched all of my old favorites because I was like, you know what? I'm just going to sit here and watch, you know, the campy ones like The Faculty and H2O. And
yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, man, H2O. I watched The Woman in Black too.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm so starved for anything any period ghost thing. I'm an absolute sucker for.
Are you? Yeah. What was the other one that was, it was actually better than I thought it was going to be. I think it was called the Others with, yeah. I mean, that movie, like when, you know, when it first came out and you watch it for the first time, I mean, I don't know about you, but I had no clue that they were the ghosts.
Oh yeah. No, yeah. The first time. Yeah. I mean, I watched that film quite young.
Yeah.
We watched it in school. I can't remember why we watched it in school. Yeah. I don't know what teacher was just, you know, had a hangover that day or whatever.
Like, watch this.
Yeah. It was the only VHS that they had. I would guess. You know what? It might have been I'm genuinely thinking about it. I went to a very Catholic school, and it might have been I think it was in religious studies we watched.
Oh, wow. They're like, this is what not
yeah,
to do.
This is if you're not good Catholic boys, this is what,
yeah, this is Christ can just show you The Exorcist. That's so funny. Well, I also want to talk to you about your other comic, because you have two coming out in December.
Yes,
which is awesome. Yeah. Busy guy. Your other comic, The Picture of Everything Else. Yeah. No, but this is a really cool and interesting take on Oscar Wilde's Dorian Gray character. Yeah. Yeah. What inspired you to tell this version of the story?
I just think there's a lot of potential in that concept, which hasn't really been explored. I think when people go back to Dorian Gray and use it for other things, as they inevitably do, because it's public domain, they tend to fixate on Dorian as this sort of, you know, because it's that sort of late Victorian era, and there's the sort of the whole decadent angle, and they go, oh, look at this sort of, you know, it's a beautiful young man. It's very, very romantic, you know, immortal, beautiful young man who does horrible things and doesn't age because he has this immortal painting of himself in his attic. And yeah, that bit's great, but no one, I've never seen anyone talk about the guy who painted the immortal painting. Right. Like, that guy's way more interesting. He painted it, and you know, if you go through the book, he's also clearly there's clearly a lot of Oscar Wilde in him as well. Like, I think people think that Dorian is Wilde's interpretation of himself. I don't think it is at all. I think Dorian is far closer to Bosie, who was Oscar Wilde's, you know, young lover who entirely caused his downfall.
Yeah.
Whose father was the one who sued Oscar Wilde into prison.
Oh, interesting.
And which basically destroyed his entire reputation and essentially killed him. He died 2 or 3 years later in poverty in France. So I think but Bosie was notoriously, you know, he was sort of always having sort of outbursts and screaming at Oscar and treating him like crap, really. And Oscar was, you know, Wilde was really devoted. And I think if you read the novel, Basil Hallward, who's the guy who paints the picture, everything else, is really devoted to Dorian. And I think there's more of Wilde in Hallward than there probably is in Dorian.
Yeah.
So being a writer and all writers being narcissists, I wanted to sort of dig in on the writer or the artist character in that. But also, I just thought it was such a ripe sort of metaphor for looking at all sorts of things. The idea that you can paint things that that do not change, or you can change things. You could change the paintings. Okay. Things could happen.
So are you sort of like exploring that theme of that old adage, you know, where art imitates life?
Yeah, and sort of vice versa, right? So it's definitely about that, but we call it the picture of everything else because it's also about the idea that it's about everything else. I'm always a bit wary of art just being about art because, you know, art is this, I think one of the things worth living for, and you know, why would we do it otherwise? It's so difficult.
Right. Why do we torture ourselves?
Yeah, why do we do it? But it's also the most rewarding thing you can do, and also I think the most rewarding, you know, it's one of the things I think makes life worth living. But part of the reason it is all of these things is because it's something with which we can communicate. That's what it primarily is, right? It's a form of communication, and it's a way of like talking to each other about anything and things that are hard to articulate. You know, that's, I always think like the best works of art, ones that communicate something, are able to communicate from the creator to the audience something that would be really difficult to just put into a couple of words. You know, be it a feeling or an emotion, or those are the same thing, but be it a feeling, or be it a sort of, you know, just a sense of a place or a time or whatever. Or just like, you know, this is how it was, or this is how I feel, or you know, those are the really worthwhile things that art can do. So I'm always very wary of art becoming just about itself. Mm-hmm. I've always very much liked the sort of, you know, over the top postmodern stuff, which does collapse into that sort of navel gazing. But if we just do that all the time, then I think we're really missing the opportunities that art gives us, because art, it's supposed to be about everything else.
Yeah. Well, and it's, you know, like about the human connection. And like you were saying, I think some things get really caught up in the actual setting or the genre or the, you know, the light flickering in the fog, but forget to realize that you need a character to drive the plot and to, you know, make people interested.
I think art can also get very neurotic about its own limitations.
Mm-hmm.
Like the amount of comics that I've read that do the sort of meta thing, you know, that become sort of meta fiction and sort of acknowledge that they are comics, or the characters know that they're in a comic or whatever. But how often those become about justifying the existence of comics, I find strange.
Yeah.
Because it's like, all right, it doesn't have to be, you know, we don't have to justify it. We're here. We've bought it. We've bought into this whole thing. You don't need to justify why we're here. But I think a lot of prose does that as well, where when it becomes about itself and it becomes about writers and it becomes about writing and it becomes about, oh, you know, the sort of angst of am I writing something that's worthwhile? Is this true? I mean, I can see why it's such an easy thing to fall into as well when you're a writer and you really want to communicate truth. And then, I can see how easily that becomes a feedback loop.
Yeah.
It's like, is this art worthwhile? That's my truth. And therefore, I'm going to make more art about, is this art worthwhile? And, you know, that's a sort of...
No, you just described my inner dialogue now.
I mean, I say it because I recognize it. Like, yeah. You know, I know it. I felt it. But yeah,
no, absolutely.
I don't know if that even answers the question.
No, that's fine. Yeah. No, you definitely did. But yeah, no, it's a cool concept. Just taking it from a completely different, you know, like you were saying, a different take on it that nobody ever has focused on, you know, in past interpretations. And there's a lot of possibilities when you start exploring stories in that way, you know, like what they did with, you know, Pride and Prejudice and zombies and Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter, you know, when you start taking these twists on historical figures or literary characters. Are there other ideas now after writing this one? Like, is your head going like, oh, I could do this, you know, with that? Or do you have any ideas for, you know, future comics based on like reimaginings?
You know what? I actually do have one of, but I won't talk about it because I think it's probably going to happen.
Oh, nice.
So, yes is the boring short cool. answer.
Perfect. So we'll have to have you on again so we can talk about that.
Yeah. Leave them wanting more.
That's right. Do you find it more challenging to work on your own material, or is it easier, like, compared to writing in an already established universe such as Sandman?
It's a good question. It is different when you're doing something from the ground up. I mean, I guess you could argue that the picture of everything else is a little bit more similar to something like Sandman, in that I am, you know, we are considering the novel, mm-hmm. Wilde's novel, to be essentially our canon. So
that's true.
It does carry on from that. I mean, it's always interesting. I don't know. I think the short answer is this: just different. Mm-hmm. Building something from the ground up is a joy, and it's why you get into, I think it should be why you get into doing this, is to sort of create worlds and play God and be a mm-hmm. lunatic narcissist. whereas going into the other sandboxes, especially ones like Sandman or the DCU, which are technically the same thing, but they have, there is a sort of joy, and I think there are certain ideas that work better with that weight of history behind them.
Okay.
You know, and these sort of mythos that have grown through hundreds and hundreds of writers and artists all doing things in a shared space. Like, there's just a joy to that.
Yeah. That's cool. Yeah, it's cool that you get to work.
I enjoy both a lot.
Yeah. It's cool that you get to work on both. You get to, you know, do your own thing, but then you can also be part of these shared universes as well.
Yeah, it's definitely nice to sort of like dip in and out and then have your own things.
Nice. And then I did see something on Twitter today that you shared. Can you tell us anything about the story you're working on for the Razor Blade Horror Anthology?
Yeah, I don't see why not. I don't think.
Is that under wraps?
I don't think James or Steve are going to sort of fly in. And James has Batman on his side now, so that's a little bit, nice. Bit nerve-wracking. But I mean, that's actually, now that you mention it, that is another horror thing, obviously, because it's razor blades, but it's also mm-hmm. another historical figure. Yeah, we're doing a story about Sweeney Todd.
Oh, yay. Awesome.
And the sort of, I think there's a very different sort of knowledge base of that character between sort of, I don't know if it's just London or Britain and the sort of American interpretation, because when I sort of talked to James and Steve, the editors at Razorblades, about the character, they're just like, oh, well, like, yeah, we know the musical, and that's where we all know him from,
right?
Whereas in like, both Lucy and I were talking about Sweeney Todd, and Sweeney Todd's something you hear about when you're a kid. It's kind of like an urban legend thing, especially if you're in London, and you know, you sort of know those streets. My dad used to work close to Fleet Street, so I knew that was a real place. And there are also a lot of people who believe that Sweeney Todd's a historical figure,
mm-hmm.
Which he's not.
Right.
Not at all. He comes from a Penny Dreadful, and a really bad one as well. Like, I've tried to read it. I tried to read it for this thing, like, the whole way through, and it's just not worth it.
Oh.
It's very much one of those sort of written, you know, week by week for the paycheck. And
oh God.
If we need to spend, you know, 50 pages talking about a sailor just to get the paycheck, then we're gonna do it. But,
bad idea.
I guess people get writers never change. But yeah, this idea that as a kid I knew he was fictional, but I then, you know, I'm talking about as quite a young kid, like maybe 7 or 8.
Oh wow.
And I knew this story, but I knew it was fictional. But then there were adults and like teachers and stuff who would insist to me that it was real.
It's a scary.
No, because they believed that it was real. Because there is this sort of, a lot of people just assume. And I remember talking to my dad about it, and he was like, "Oh, I thought that was real as well." And I mean, like, as in within the last couple of months, because I was doing the story, I was like, "Oh, do you remember me talking about Sweeney Todd as a kid?" And he was like, "Oh, I still thought that was a real thing." So it's a weird, that I think, especially as a kid, that's a very weird space to find yourself in, where you sort of know something's, or you're convinced something's fictional, and then people who trust and who have authority and should know better than you are mm-hmm. telling you that it's real. And it's a weird sort of almost dreamlike confusion for a child. And yeah, so that's kind of what the story's about.
Okay. So are you reliving any trauma in writing it?
Just bafflement. Yeah. Not childhood trauma, just childhood sort of bafflement.
Well, good. Well, and when is that coming out?
I think that's going to be in the winter edition. It should be December.
Awesome. That's great. And so, I mean, you mentioned briefly that you worked on, I think you said Superman, but have you ever thought about tackling another genre other than horror, like with your own material?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, Limbo wasn't really horror.
Right.
I think the thing that interests me about doing horror in comic... Oh, no, I'm just going to talk about horror again. So we're not horror.
Go for it.
The thing that interests me about horror in comics is that I don't think straight-up horror works in comics. You don't have jump scares in comics. You don't have the sort of surprise which prose can do because... You know, words can sneak up on you, but the picture, you can kind of see it in a peripheral before you before you get to the next panel. So you can't make people jump.
That's true. Yeah. I never thought about it that way. Yeah.
So when you do horror in comics, you have to plug it into other things and you have to work around that kind of thing, which is why I like doing horror in comics, because it always makes you kind of innovate.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to do something interesting, but that also means that I end up plugging other genres into it, like Homesick Pilots is, you know, has that sort of 90s teen angst stuff, and
mm-hmm.
The Picture of Everything Else is definitely a sort of historical drama as well,
some steampunk,
like Lucifer went all over the place, you know. It let us sort of tell any kind of story. Yeah, I like the sort of trappings of horror. Very much like other things. I would say sort of 90% of the stuff I read isn't horror.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure I'll get there. At the moment, I'm kind of caught up on ghosts and ghosts as a concept. And I don't think ghost stories have to be horror stories at all.
That's true.
You know, we're all very haunted things. And I don't think most of us are that scary, really.
Yeah, well, I even think that, like, with Lock and Key, for example, it's not really about ghosts, but it has a ghost-like feel, I guess.
I would say Lock and Key is also a very good example of what I'm saying about you can't do sort of scary horror in comics, because Lock and Key doesn't really try to either. It feels very Joe Hill, you know, in the way his, like, horror novels do.
Mm-hmm.
And it does feel quite Stephen King, but, you know, in its sort of trappings. But it's not sort of focused on the horror stuff. At least once you get past that first book, it really opens up and it tells all kinds of stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Once you get past the initial, like, shock of what's happening, it gets
blood and
gets
guts more, at the beginning.
Yeah, it gets more into, like, just the story of the family itself.
Yeah, I mean, it has a Calvin and Hobbes issue.
Yeah. Exactly. Like group therapy, really. Do you think you'll ever write a novel, actually, like a horror novel? Have you ever wanted to? Or
I kept making noise about getting a novel done before I was 30, and I now have 2 months, so that's not going to happen.
Okay.
But yeah, I've started one, which I'm determined to finish, which isn't a horror novel at all. I think when I do genre stuff, I push towards horror very very naturally, but I think when I do prose, it tends to be a little bit more, I don't know, it's still in the realm of something maybe like Vonnegut. But I love that kind of stuff. I love funny stuff. I love Pratchett. So you know, and I love sort of Don DeLillo and David Foster Wallace and all that sort of vaguely pretentious.
Yeah.
but you know, very interesting stuff. So yeah, I think that will probably be where you'll see me push away from horror the quickest.
Right. Okay. You never know. You might, once you make the, you know, do the first novel and get the, you know, the hang of it, the feel for it, you'd be surprised. You might want to start, oh, maybe I could do this in horror or sci-fi even, you know?
Yeah. Then the second one will just all be just hatchets. Just body parts.
Just chopping people up. That's it. A true horror novel. Horror into itself. So a random question. If you could live inside any of the worlds you've created, which one would it be?
Oh, so it's an interesting question for a horror writer.
I know.
I don't know. It's interesting. There's always the interesting sort of side of it where I guess like in Homesick Pilots, there are ghosts and they do some scary things. But I guess if you have straight up ghosts like that, you've got proof of an afterlife, which would be nice.
That's true.
Yeah, I guess that. I mean, picture everything else is very much like our world, but with serial killer painters.
Nice. Well, before I let you go, I just wanted to do some fun random questions. Just five quick fire ones. Star Wars or Star Trek?
Neither.
Neither. Okay. Favorite Game of Thrones character?
Ooh.
I mean, there's like 100 to choose from, but no pressure.
Jon Snow's the really boring one, isn't it? But it's a good character.
He's a good one. Yeah.
Good arc. Very yeah. Good arc.
Nice.
Actually, coffee or tea? Aria. Yeah.
coffee or tea?
Coffee. Okay. I drink gallons of both, but I wouldn't survive without coffee.
Nice. Do you have any tattoos?
Yes.
How many?
Three or four. I was meant to get more, and then I just lost interest.
Nice. And lastly, your favorite Batman actor portrayal?
I'm very much looking forward to Patterson because mainly based off how he basically played psychotic Bruce Wayne already in Cosmopolis. I don't know. I might have to go right back to Adam West. It's just...
Oh, yeah.
It's just joy. I love it so much.
Yeah. Well, that's good. I'm glad you didn't say, like, you know, one of the other ones that we won't mention, but... Yeah, I think Michael Keaton's version actually is very underrated.
Keaton's fantastic in anything.
Yeah, I mean, it was sort of you know, at the time it was I remember it was a big hit when it came out, big blockbuster. But I think he did a good job, you know, considering. I mean, it's evolved so much from since then, and it's gotten pretty dark. Yeah, darker.
I can only imagine like when that film was announced, the sort of. Like, there must have been a fair bit of bafflement that Keaton was cast, right? Like, because he's a comedian.
Yeah.
And
like a rom-com, you know, it's a lot of romantic stuff, yeah.
But yeah, no, I mean, the fact that he's still kind of doing, you know, the amount of sort of legacy he has from that film, and, you know, obviously it's, you know, sort of intertextual with how they cast him as the Vulture and Birdman and, like, all of these sort of things. Like, it's still... You know, he really sent like a shockwave out with that role.
Yeah, and it's sort of like with Birdman, it kind of like gave it like a resurgence. You know, people, you know, that were younger that you know hadn't seen it, I think went back and watched it. You know, that maybe didn't even you know bother beforehand. So, yeah, I think he did a good job, and Christian Bale, of course, did a great job too. But
yeah, I mean, Christian Bale, similar to the Robert Pattinson thing, like. I've always been convinced that they cast Christian Bale because of his American Psycho role.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Like, I do find it interesting that we've had two Batman actors who've played sort of psychotic city guys in the very recent past when they're cast as Batman.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I mean, I think it brings like more of a, I guess, like an edgier, you know, role to it. I'm, you know, because I think with the comics, people think that comic books, especially with superheroes, that a lot of them are light and fluffy or whatever. But when you start reading the different variations of Batman that are out there, there are some really dark and twisted, you know, Batman stories. So yeah, I think
he's got to have some crazy behind the eyes, right? If he's gonna dress up like a bat and like beat people up.
Yeah, exactly. It's got to be a good Bruce Wayne too, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's the guy he's dressing up like a bat. So you got to believe that he'd get away with it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I know it's super late and you're probably wanting to go to sleep at this point. I really appreciate you coming on, especially with the time difference. I had a blast talking to you. It was really, really fun. So thank you for coming on.
Thanks very much for having me.
Yeah. So everybody make sure to get a copy of Homesick Pilots on December 9th. And then the picture of everything else is on December 12th. Dan Waters, thank you again.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks so much.
And we're back. You know, so this is Dan's second time on the show. He was actually on almost a year ago exactly to today, December 8th of last year. He was on the show talking with Jeff about Lucifer and his book Coffin Brown. And Coffin Bound.
It was probably a brown coffin.
I mean, statistically speaking, it's probably a brown coffin, yes. but that was 304 episodes ago, which is kind of insane that between now and last year, we've released over 300 episodes. But
yeah,
it's cool that he came back on and talked to more. I really enjoyed the last interview he did. I enjoyed this one with you, and I look forward to him coming back on the talk again.
Yeah, so do I. Yeah, it was really fun, and we talked about some of his older stuff too, as you just heard. So that's kind of nice. We get to hear a little bit of a Lucifer talk as well.
Yeah, Lucifer is such a good series in the comics. And the show's good too. I like the show, but the comics are so good.
Yeah, well, it's such a difference. You know, the show's really campy and it's entertaining, but the comics are dark and, you know, getting back to like that horror genre that he does so well. So, yeah, it's a good one.
For sure. I need to check out some of his new stuff because they sound amazing.
Oh, yeah. I can't wait. they come out December 9th and December 12th. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. So now it's today is the 3rd of December. You have plenty of time to go out and order those and tell your LCS about those because you definitely want to pick those up because you don't want to sleep on anything Dan writes because it's good stuff.
Yep.
And with that, I think that's a show. I think that if you liked that, listening out there, all you listeners, if you liked what you heard here with Melissa talking with Dan or just with Dan or just Melissa, whichever one you want there, go over to spoilerverse.com and check out all of our back issues because we've got over 500 episodes of interviews, of movie reviews, comic reviews, of just conversations and topics. A lot of interviews. We've been doing a lot of those lately, and they're a lot of fun. But go check them out. We got tons of people up there you may know, people you may not know, that you will learn about, and then go support them because they're all awesome. Because we only have awesome people on the show, that's for sure. And we have other podcasts on the network, too. We've got Bridging the Geek Domes and Misery Point Radio. And over on my other podcast, Haphazard Adventures, right now, for the month of December, my wife and I are doing an episode every day where we picked up the Brewer's Advent calendar from Costco, and we're reviewing the beer each day as we go through the Advent calendar for the month of December, which is a lot of fun.
Cool.
Which means we get to try some weird German beer every day.
I'm totally going to listen to that. That sounds really cool.
it's a lot of fun because neither my wife nor I really know anything about beer besides like how to drink it, you know? So we're always like trying to talk it up and like, yeah, it's a beer with a light hint of pomegranate and like reading the app what it says it is. And like, I mean, like we have no idea what the hell any of this means.
The tasting notes.
Right. It tastes like beer to me. But it's a lot of fun. But we did it last year and we're doing it again this year. And it's a lot of fun. So yeah, it's over at Half-Ass Adventures. We also have more stuff on the site. Melissa, what else is on the site?
Well, we have some really cool merchandise. You can get yourself a Spoiler Country hoodie like I have, and mugs and hats and t-shirts and all kinds of fun stuff so you can sport our gear.
Yeah, and that all that money goes back to help support the site and everything we do here, because if you ever try to do a podcast, you know it's not free, but it's free for everybody listening, and it's a lot of fun, though. But yeah, so do that. Also, go to scpod.us/Discord and join our public Discord server. Come chat with us. We got some contests I'm going to be doing here pretty soon, so you definitely want to get over there and get involved in that. And with that, I think that's the show. I think there's just one thing left for us to do.
I think so.
And Notions of Podcasts.
We are Cthulhu.
And as Cthulhu compels you to do,
open the mind
and read more. And just read a lot, because the more you read, the more open your mind is, and the more you are open to more conversations.
Absolutely. The more you know.
The more you know.